Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Matos v. O'Sullivan. Ms. Mannix?
May it please the Court. We're here today to address a question that I don't believe has been squarely addressed before this Court before. And that is, how obvious does a risk have to be before it can give rise to a circumstantial inference that the actors, the prison actors involved with the person who ultimately was proven to be suicidal, there was enough evidence that you may pass a summary judgment.
Here's my question for you. It's sort of a bottom line question. Is it your position that every prisoner who displays signs of grief or depression should be placed on a suicide watch? What I'm trying to figure out is what made Mr. Matos's grief and depression different?
I think it's different in a couple of respects. The first respect is that he wasn't just a prisoner who was observed by a prison guard to be upset. He was somebody who was specifically referred on at least two occasions, if not more, for an evaluation by someone with special training in determining whether he was somebody who posed a serious suicide risk or required some sort of mental illness treatment. And in this case, I think that the evidence shows that, in fact, there was a determination by Wozcak that he required some sort of treatment. The first time she saw him, she referred him for a psychotropic consultation, although the record does not indicate that that, in fact, was carried out. The second time she saw him, she said he needed to be included in a stress management program, although that was never there's no evidence that that was ever carried out. So I think here, this isn't just somebody who's sort of wandering around a prison upset and it happens to be observed by a prison guard. He's somebody who repeatedly brought himself to the attention when he asked to see Amy Lipkaman, the team crisis member. He's somebody who was specifically referred to CASC at least twice. He was someone who had a lot of contact with people who were supposed to be specially trained to identify that he was different, that he wasn't just somebody who was a little shaken up, or a little upset, and a little depressed. I think that that is really what is crucial in this case that's different. And in addition to that, we have, and I think it ties in with that, we have Dr. Slensky, our expert, psychiatric expert's testimony, that this was blindingly obvious to anybody who had training like either Costa or Terrell. Somebody who was a, quote, the perfect candidate for suicide. And that in view of the latent obviousness of his likelihood of suicide, that we have met that standard that Farmer versus Dunning states, that whether a prison official has the requisite knowledge of a substantial risk is a question of fact subject to demonstration in the usual ways, including inference from circumstantial evidence that the risk was so obvious. That's not a direct quote, but that's sort of a condensed quote. And I think that's what makes our situation very different. Cox, and I actually plan to go through defendant by defendant, to talk about what they knew and why it should have been obvious to each of them that this was not a person who was just having a bad day. This was a person who was in serious need of help.
Well, would you be kind enough to start out with Warden O'Sullivan? Because I'm wondering what facts you allege show that the constitutional violation at issue occurred at Warden O'Sullivan's direction or with his knowledge or consent.
I will concede that the case against Warden O'Sullivan is absolutely the most difficult that we have. I think on the opposite end of the spectrum is Cox. With regard to Warden O'Sullivan, I think that the evidence showed that it was his job to know what was going on. He was the chief administrator of all the programs in the hospital, including the mental health program, and he was specifically responsible for implementing and enforcing the administrative directive that was supposed to govern how people in the prison dealt with someone in Mr. Matto's situation. That's really what the evidence shows as to that, as to Warden O'Sullivan. I don't know if you want me to...
Well, we know that, you know, I mean, the doctrine of respondent superior can't be used to establish Section 1983 liability. So, you know, his failure to supervise the provision, you know, of mental health service, just, you know, that can't be enough.
Right. I'm sorry. I understand that, Your Honor. But I guess our point is a little bit different, and that is, we have to show, and we have to do it because there's no admission. Nobody in this case, none of the defendants has said, oh, heck, we knew he was, you know, this far from jumping over the ledge, and we didn't do anything. I don't know that that's going to be that present in very many cases. But we have to show with circumstances giving rise to an inference of knowledge in the face of a denial by the defendant that they had that knowledge. And with regard to Warden O'Sullivan, I'm not suggesting he should be responsible under a respondeat superior. I'm suggesting that the reason he should have had knowledge of Matto's situation are the circumstances I've described. On the other, I'm sorry, have I answered your question, Your Honor?
Well, Ms. Max, isn't it true to the extent that inquiry has been made of the deceased about when he was in custody, he denied any suicidal tendency, so clearly they must have been looking, and Dr. Koskel's report seems to suggest that. So you're just saying they drew the wrong medical conclusion?
Excuse me. No, I'm sorry. No, Your Honor. I'm not suggesting they drew the wrong medical conclusion. I'm suggesting, especially with respect to Cox, that she actually knew he had a problem, irrespective of her denial. She knew he was depressed. He was crying. He had asked to see, at least the second time she saw him, he knew he had asked for help. He had asked to see a crisis team member. He repeatedly told basically anybody who had listened to him that he was very depressed, although he said he didn't have, I think it was a suicide...
Tenancy.
He denies not suicidal.
Right.
He's feeling depressed, but not suicidal. Again,
it wasn't, from what we can tell in the record to date, it was triggered by the death of a parent, right?
That's my understanding, Your Honor, yes.
We couldn't use that as a baseline, could we, of every inmate who loses an intimate family member, that the possession of, so to speak, would point to suicidal tendencies, right?
No, Your Honor, I agree with that. I think here it's definitely an assessment of the totality of the circumstances. Although he denied being suicidal, he explicitly said he was depressed. He said he was frustrated and confused. He was crying. He stated, he verbalized that he was having difficulty.
What percentage of prisoners are these things true? And most prisoners are disturbed in one way or another.
Your Honor, I really don't know from the record what that percentage would be, and I don't have any...
Isn't that essential? And the reason I ask this is because thinking about a comparison between this case and, say, the Jootsie Johnson case, which I'm quite perplexed that none of the parties' briefs discusses, we held that a much more distressed prisoner than this, so far as I could see, did not have to be put on suicide watch. Now, why is it that Jootsie Johnson did not have to be put on suicide watch, but this prisoner did?
I understand Jootsie Johnson, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, to essentially stand for the proposition, and it was a little bit of a different situation because it was a Federal Tort Claims Act, but...
Yes, so all the plaintiff had to show was negligence, and we held that it wasn't even negligent.
I'm sorry, my recollection was it was the case more looked at proximate cause. But I could be wrong on that. But what I recall about that case was he was identified as acting bizarrely, strangely, but there was not the strange bizarre, he was like picking at doors and doing weird stuff, didn't point to a suicidal problem. It pointed to perhaps a problem.
That's exactly the reason why I'm asking this question. Many prisoners are disturbed or odd or depressed or self-destructive. Some really tiny percentage of that class then commits suicide. But if the prison is under an obligation to put on suicide watch all those people who exhibit one of these conceivable related tendencies, then prisons will be a much worse place than they are. It is beastly to be on suicide watch.
I'll definitely take your word on that. It doesn't sound very attractive.
No, you like to sit around in a cell stripped of anything that you could use for any purpose. You're basically in a straitjacket 24 hours a day.
I'm trying to stay out of cells overall, whether with a straitjacket.
It is inhumane to put on suicide watch anybody who is not a very serious risk. And that's why my question is, how was this person really demonstrably different from other disturbed, problematic prisoners?
Okay. The first thing I would say in response to that is we had the expert testimony of Dr. Slunsky, who said this isn't just somebody who exhibited maybe a possible little propensity to suicide. He said that he exhibited every cardinal sign or indicator of suicide, that he exhibited all of them, and that anybody with a training like Cox or Terrell, or presumably Lipkaman, because he had also received some training, would have and should have recognized those. And this was a person who was specifically brought to their attention. It wasn't left for them to sort of pick him out of the population.
Let me ask this question in a different way. Have you put into the record, or have you pointed to in the medical literature, any of the studies about what is associated objectively with suicide?
Yes, Your Honor. Dr. Slunsky testified to several factors, which he...
No.
I'm sorry.
Objective studies.
I don't believe... I'm just
recalling... We talked a lot in Judy Johnson about the need for such evidence.
I don't believe... I believe that we relied pretty extensively on Dr. Slunsky's deposition testimony. I don't believe...
And what was it based on?
His expertise as a psychiatrist.
No.
It
has to be based on something, right? This is a Daubert point. An expert can't just say, it's so because I know it. It has to refer to the literature or a study he has done. So I'm asking, what was the basis?
I do not believe that he referred to any specific study. I do recall him saying in his deposition that the literature indicates, all of the literature indicates statements along those lines, and he wasn't asked further in his deposition what specifically he relied on in the literature, but he stated that the literature showed that these are the signs that you look for in a suicide case.
Ms. Mannix, I'm getting into your rebuttal time, and I'm sorry, but to me, the key to this case seems to be in this medical history form, the reception periodic medical history. And the record seems to be very unclear as to who filled out the form, where it was kept, who saw it, and when. Can you clarify any of this?
My understanding is that that document was completed by a person who signed it. I don't know. In connection with Matto's first incarceration, I believe in August of 96. It's my understanding that it was part of his medical record. I believe that the defendants, Terrell and Cox, admitted that it was part of his medical record and that they had access to his medical record. Dr. Terrell, in a letter written after Matthews killed himself, indicated that he had seen the letter.
But Dr. Bartels, I mean, it's the very same day, and he's taking this, you know, he's doing this interview, and yet there's nothing in there. What, you know?
I think that's one of the really problematic aspects of what Dr. Bartels, or I think he's a psychologist, Mr. Bartels did. Some other interviewer on the same day was able to elicit from him, Matos, that he'd had this history of suicide. He had been diagnosed with being manic depressive, and had and indicated an urgent need for mental health referral. And yet, the same day, Bartels, who was supposed to be conducting a psychological screening of this person, they write down what amounts to a form letter, because he reiterates exactly the, almost exactly the same thing later. And I think that that's really telling about what Bartels was doing. And our argument with Bartels is that he was so far beyond the pale of what was an acceptable medical screening or psychological screening, that he was deliberately indifferent, and we've cited this court's a state of cold case on that issue. Thanks. I'll reserve whatever else is left for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Manis. Ms. Wisher?
May it please the court, counsel, Nadine Wicker, Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of the State Defendants, Amy Lipkin, Charles Bartels, and William O'Sullivan. The grant of summary judgment on behalf of the State Defendants was correct and should be affirmed. None of the State Defendants acted with deliberate indifference, which means that none of them knew of and disregarded a substantial risk of suicide.
Whose job is it to review the reception and periodic medical history form? And why wouldn't Dr. Bartels have reviewed this information as part of his intake examination?
Just from examining the document, the reception of periodic medical history form appears to be a form that a medical doctor filled out listing the types of medication that Mr. Matos was on, which also includes psychiatric medication, which is a separate part of the intake process than the screening, the psychological evaluation by Bartels. That is for the purpose of making sure that inmates who are entering the institution are adjusted. There's a high rate of suicide usually after an inmate first enters an institution. So the purposes of those two screening processes, from what I can tell from the record, are different.
That's not what I asked you was whose job is it? And whose job is it to review that form? And why wouldn't Dr. Bartels have reviewed the form? That's my question.
Okay, my understanding is that this form belongs in the master file of the inmate as well as the medical file, which Bartels in the screening process does not have access to. My point being that the purpose of Bartels screening is not necessarily to list all these medications and history that was done in the other part of the screening. It's to make sure that he is going to be adjusted to the prison society.
Ms. Wickern, I don't want to upset you, but whose job is it?
The record is silent as to...
That's a good answer. The answer.
The record does indicate that Bartels did not see that document, which was in 1996. There's nothing in the record from 1998 that he filled out a similar form, and also nothing to indicate that anyone saw another form of this kind. Bartels only saw Mr. Matos two times at Joliet Correctional Center. It's important to point out that Mr. Matos spent the rest of his time at Western Correctional Center. And the last time that Mr. Bartels saw Mr. Matos was 2 months before he committed suicide. The job description of Dr. Bartels is that he screens all of the inmates who enter Joliet and are processed through to other institutions or who stay there. I believe he sees about 700 inmates a year, which might give you an indication of the type of screening process that occurs. There's nothing to indicate that Mr. Bartels had any knowledge of suicidal feelings by Mr. Matos. In fact, both times, the record indicates that he denied feeling suicidal in his conversations with Mr. Bartels.
You know, those two forms, the 96 and the 98, they are virtually the same. Those are, you know, like form letters that you might receive through the mail. That was... Do you find that the least bit troubling, that it's almost word for word?
Perhaps it might be more troubling if it had been different people that came out the same way, but it is the same individual. So it's not that unlikely that
that the words would be exactly the same.
I'm sure that doctors and lawyers use their same words in their notes, that over time, I'm sure he has a checklist that he asks questions of, and this reflects the answers to the questions that he asked. With regard to Officer Lipkin, she had only had contact with Mr. Matos one time, 1 month before he committed suicide on July 4th. In response to his request to see someone on the crisis team, to talk about the death of his father. Mrs. Lipkman responded immediately to his request, and he indicated to her that although he was feeling sad that over the death of his father, that he did not have feelings of suicide and that he could deal with the problems.
Of course, the crisis counselor's note says that he's grieving the death of his mother and father.
Which is seems to be a mistake, because
quite an error, isn't it? I mean, it does say something about the level of attentiveness and care, doesn't it?
Not having been at the conversation, if he was upset, maybe she misunderstood what he was saying. He was also talking about the fact that he could not meet with his family since he had been transferred from Joliet to Weston, and his wing was on lockdown, so perhaps he was talking about not being able to contact his mother. As I see my time is up, I'll reserve the rest of my argument regarding Will No. Sullivan for my brief, and we ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you, Ms. Wickman. Mr. Best?
Thank you. Good morning. I'd like to start with Dr. Terrell. I think the point on him, he is not a psychologist. He was involved in the treatment of a seizure disorder, which he did, and there was no indication from his records or treatment that there was any suicidal intent. So I don't think there's any question about Dr. Terrell. Then on Dr. Cox, I think the key point with Dr. Cox is the fact that she did specifically address suicide with the patient, with the inmate. So again, we're not talking about a medical malpractice case or if she made a bad diagnosis or what she should have done. What we're talking about, is there proof that she knew or she had other indifference? So my point is the fact that she specifically addressed it both times with the inmate and he denied. There's no contradiction that he denied that he was suicidal.
You know, the only thing I'm wondering about in relation to that is that in a memorandum that was prepared after Mr. Mattis's suicide, Dr. Terrell indicated that a review of his medical file revealed a history of prior psychological illness and a previous suicide attempt. And if that information was available to Dr. Terrell and to others after Mattis's death, what I'm wondering about is why Dr. Cox wouldn't have reviewed it while she was treating Mr. Matos.
Okay. And the record does not address that. So there's two explanations. One, it was in the file, she didn't see it, okay, or it was not in the file. But what I submit is that I believe any causal connection, or it's all eliminated as a point in this case, is because she did specifically address suicide herself. So I think that is the key why that makes that irrelevant in regard to other indifference, because she did bring it up.
Well, would it be critical, Mr. Beth, if she were aware how recent the suicide, relatively recent the suicide attempt was?
I don't think so, because she brought it up. I mean, I think that's where...
She brought up the issue.
The issue of suicide.
Do we know from the record whether or not he responded that in 95 he had that train incident?
Well, the only thing we can go by is her office, her medical record, which is very clear and very detailed, and she specifically puts in there both times she denied any suicide intention, and so that is undisputed. That's what the record is. So my point is, and I would follow up, and that was a comment in my note, I think the only thing that the plaintiff has proven is that there is some stress in Mr. Matos' life, but how is that different than any other physician? And I don't think that makes a case, and that's why summary judgment was proper. That's all I have. Unless there's any other questions?
Apparently not. Thank you, Mr. Best. Ms. Mannix?
Again, just with regard to what Mr. Best had discussed, it seems like they're hinging their case on the fact that that Mathis didn't say, "Hello, I'm suicidal, please help me." I don't believe that we're required to prove either A, that there's an admission by the defendant that they knew he was suicidal, or that you have to have an assertion by the person who eventually killed himself that he is suicidal. He was depressed by his own admission. He stated he was having difficulty coping, and he did everything but state, please help me, that I'm suicidal. Again, these are trained individuals who are supposed to see the signs even when a person doesn't walk up to them and say, hi, I'm suicidal.
Does the record indicate, Ms. Mullins, that he ever conveyed the 95 incident to the any of the physicians or personnel?
The only thing that the record really indicates on that is that that was part of his medical records, that that was, and I believe there was an admission in response to our additional statement of facts in response to the Trevelyan Cox motion for summary judgment, which they admitted that, that the medical records were available for their review. More than one of them denied reviewing them in their affidavits, but I don't believe there's any affirmative evidence in the record that they in fact reviewed them.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.